to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here again in Grays Lake, Illinois. Delighted to be back with some folks talking about some important topics and some history of the church, particularly in Scotland. But let me introduce to you first one of our regulars. We have Jim Cassidy, the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back to the program, Jim. It's always good to talk to you. Good to see you today.
Yeah, good to be here, Camden. How are you doing? Hope you're doing well up there, and everybody is safe and healthy.
So. Yeah, I think we're doing fine. We'll see. No one's knocked down the door of my house or anything. No, but these are troubled times. I kind of wish I was overseas with our guest for the moment, because things have been really odd in the United States, not only this year, but especially this week, and we'll just leave it at that. But we're very pleased to welcome to the program for the very first time Mr. Matthew Vogan, who is with the Reformation Scotland. He's also a contributor and an editor of a wonderful new book we're going to be talking about today. But let me say welcome, Matthew. It's good to see you, and welcome to the program from overseas.
Thank you very much, and it's good to speak with you, and good to meet you.
Yeah, likewise. I'm excited to talk today about this new book we have. We got a few copies here on hand. This is a tremendous volume, Sermons on Jeremiah's Lamentations by none other than David Dixon. We're going to be speaking about him, learning about him, but it's also learning about his preaching ministry and this particular volume, which is with Naphtali Press Special Editions. Many of you know, of course, the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. We just recently had yet another interview with a contributor to that journal and an editor, Nick Wilborn. And with the new edition of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal is out, issue number 16. For 2020, so head on over to cpjournal.com to subscribe if you haven't already. And now you can subscribe and have your subscription renew annually. But the primary editor and worker on that journal is none other than Chris Caldwell, and he also works and heads up Naphtali Press. And this is a wonderful new volume, like I said, in this special series, the Naphtali Press Special Editions, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I do want to begin our time today just mentioning that I have, thank you to Mr. Caldwell and Mr. Vogan here, three copies of this wonderful book. And it is tremendous. We're going to talk all about it today, but it's printed well. It's certainly a volume that will do well on your shelf. You'll like to have it there, even just from its aesthetic and value and its printing quality. Not to say anything about the tremendous content that's in it. But if you'd like a copy of this book, which is well worth it, we have three copies to give away. Very simply, I'm just going to pick three names from our email newsletter subscription list, three emails on the Thursday after this episode is published. So if you'd like to enter, all you got to do is subscribe to the email newsletter. Just head on over to reformedforum.org. At the bottom of most all the pages, you'll see a footer. And you just type in your email address and you'll be subscribed. You can start getting our emails. And on the Thursday after this publication of this podcast episode, I'll go in and randomly select three names and then contact you directly and see if I can get your address and mail you a copy of the book. Simple as that. If you're already subscribed, then you're already entered. Don't need to worry about it. If I contact you and don't hear from you for quite a while, or if you tell me you'd rather have let someone else have the book and you'll buy your own, we'll work that out too. But anyway, that's how we'll go through the process. But Matthew, I'd be interested to give you an opportunity now just to introduce our listeners perhaps to Reformation Scotland. We were just speaking before recording a little bit about it. But before we get into David Dixon and his history in the great country and kingdom of Scotland, I'd love for you to speak a little bit about your efforts there in the church, seeking to educate and to bring renewal.
Sure, thanks very much. Yeah, I've been working full-time for Reformation Scotland for just over 5 years, and what we're really trying to do is, it's not a profit organization, it's something that's looking to support the church and to support Christians. And it just seems like in Scotland and in the church, we've lost touch with our heritage, our Reformed heritage. And we really, treasure the Westminster Standards and that foundation that was given to us, and also the men who were about that period in the church, these giants like David Dixon, have so much to offer us in terms of their writings. And one of the things that we do is to dig into those gold mines and to bring for the use of Christians and the church today material, whether it's blog articles or in other ways, you know, trying to make that usable and useful and fresh for people to make use of in the church. So really trying to connect churches. A lot of, you know, our churches in Scotland have just lost touch. And even in, you know, quite Reformed churches, there's not that familiarity with this heritage, just simply because it hasn't really been republished in the way that some of the Puritan writers have been.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's an important need there, and people can find out more on your website, no doubt, at reformationscotland.org. I see you also have some resources available online, as well as an email subscription there and a way to contact you. So no doubt many of our listeners are in Scotland. If they haven't connected already, connect. But even if you're outside of the country, it's always helpful to get acquainted and to gain some knowledge about the efforts there. And to support prayerfully and otherwise. So reformationscotland.org is a great place to go and to connect on those fronts. Matthew, I was wondering, as I saw this, and this is the first copy from the Neftali special, the Neftali Press special editions that I have physically. And I was excited to see it and also to dig in and learn a bit about this series and how it functions, because it's a different type of series and a different type of publishing model than we have come to expect, at least in the present day. Could you help us describe a little bit about the origins of this project, but even its funding and how it came about, so that we can actually hold copies of this work that didn't previously exist?
Sure. I think it was when I, you know, came up with the idea to Chris Coldwell of getting involved in editing this, it sort of sparked that idea of, you know, we could have a series which would be funded by sponsors, and a bit like the old subscription model. So like in Scotland, for instance, a lot of the works from this period that were published in the 19th century were published by the Woodrow Society or other organizations, and they worked on this subscriber model. And so the reason that this volume has been able to be published is due to the funding from those who've entered into as sponsors. So yeah, it's an unusual model from that point of view, but it helps to produce, you know, aesthetically pleasing and well produced and well edited publications like this. And yeah, that sparked Chris's interest in the idea of this kind of series, because sometimes some volumes can have a kind of more niche interest, but other volumes have more wider appeal. And so in some ways it helps to take some of those lesser volumes that don't have such a great appeal and bring them in together with those that are of greater interest to a wider group of people, really. So yeah,
I think we can all certainly agree, you know, there are tremendous historical works that we like to see exist, but if you take a proposal to the various existing publishing companies, and there are most all, organized as nonprofit organizations, whatever country they're organized in. But still, they have to keep the lights on. And if a book might cost several thousands of dollars or more, tens of thousands of dollars to produce, theoretically, and you might only sell a handful, we can acknowledge that it's important that this work exists, and it would be a great benefit and blessing to the church. But with, you know, under the current model of just seeking to sell copies to fund these things, it's not economically viable. And so you end up with this impasse. So I think the subscription model, or, you know, older patronage models, are so encouraging that we can see people that understand the need and want to support it and might contribute a few hundred dollars, whereas, you know, you could never, unless you're selling to libraries, that's the racket in the United States, you know, sell the book for $200, you know. You don't have to, but we have people that see the need and want to support it, and therefore books like this can exist and be made available to the church for centuries now. Literally, this volume could last centuries as long as it's, you know, in a, you know, not too humid of an environment. And that wouldn't have been possible without all the supporters that are listed here in the front of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, I should say that, you know, the series needs more annual sponsors in order to make big things happen, you know, right, like this work. And but also, I think, you know, Reformation Heritage Books coming on as a co-publisher, yes, you know, they've kind of stepped in there where another publisher might have stood back and said, well, you know, has anyone heard of, you know, this, or is anyone going to really, is this going to be commercially successful? But they've got in behind that, you know, so, yeah.
And they've done tremendous work as well. We're very thankful to Reformation Heritage Books. We speak about a lot of their books, and they're very committed to, they're very mission focused in advocating for historical works and translating and support. You know, they put their money where their mouth is, and to use that phrase, and in a very encouraging way. So I'm thankful to them, and would like to encourage publicly encourage more of that work. It's tremendous. Tell us a bit about your experience with David Dixon, the historical figure, and how you came about these particular manuscripts. And I guess along those lines, you can even tell us their historical origin. I mean, this isn't like you went to a library and found an existing published copy of these works. There's a lot more sleuthing and legwork that had to happen in order to make this available.
Yeah, sure. It's these are from manuscript, these sermons, and they've never been published before, as you say. They were in a university library. And I decided to go along, and I was looking at some other manuscripts for Chris Coldwell, actually, by James Durham. And I noticed in the catalogue that there was this item of sermons by David Dixon on Lamentations. And so I was interested to see it. And, you know, I could still remember opening it up for the first time. This was July 2017. Mm. And when you open it up and you see the handwriting, and actually the handwriting was, although it's 17th century handwriting, it was quite easy to read, you know, real copperplate stuff. And I thought, well, you know, this is just such a treasure. And imagine a whole series of sermons, complete series of sermons on Lamentations. And so actually within weeks, I managed to collaborate with someone to start transcribing that. And that was just the initial process, you know, and I must say that Chris Coldwell put in a lot of work and painstakingly going back over that, checking it against the images and everything like that, because it's still, even if it's easy to read, it's still in Old Scots, or, you know, there's still things that are tricky along the way. But yeah, these are sermons that, it's tremendous to think of the fact that in one sense no one's seen them, they've not come to wider view, you know, only a few hands have handled them, really. It's lain obscure in a university library, passed down perhaps in one family for generations, and very few people have seen and read these sermons since they were first preached, and yet they've come, in the providence of God, they've come to public view at this particular time, you know, in history, almost 400 years later. Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable. That's the kind of story that makes nerds like us just get super excited, you know, imagining you in the library and finding these old dusty manuscripts and turning it into a book. Great stuff. Tell us a little bit about David Dixon, his biography, sort of who he was, his significance, and the fruitfulness of his ministry.
Sure. David Dixon has been regarded as one of the most significant ministers and preachers, and indeed theologians from the time of the Second Reformation in Scotland. And when I say the Second Reformation in Scotland, I'm meaning especially that period from the signing of the National Covenant in 1638, right the way through to at least 1662. So that sort of period that is around about the time of the Westminster Assembly. And his life, he was born in around about 1583, and his life really spans the fall and the rise and the fall again of the Scottish Church, and you know the different experiences and providences that the Scottish Church had during that time, a period of persecution, a period of decline, but also, as I say, a period of riches where people that were godly ministers, great theologians came to the fore. And John Livingston, who's one of the main ministers of that time as well, someone once asked him, well, who would you take to be the greatest gospel minister in Scotland? And he had no doubt that David Dixon was the greatest that he ever knew. And he was significant as a leader during the time of this sort of period, the 1620s and the 1630s especially, when there was a period of decline and things were being forced on the Scottish Church by the king and the bishops. And he helped to lead the resistance against that. In fact, he was exiled up to Turriff, which is in Aberdeenshire, so up to the far north because of his standing out against royal policies and the way that basically the state was trying to control the church. So that was that period. And then during his ministry in Irvine in Ayrshire, which is just below Glasgow, he experienced the time of revival. And the time of revival really came on the heels of his return from exile, his return from being banished up to the far north. And people flocked to hear him, particularly on a Monday, which was the market day. And there was this period of revival that was called by people that were not well disposed to it, the Stourton sickness, because the whole valley was the Stourton Valley. And it was people from the whole district who were being converted and changed. Dixon was a professor of divinity in Glasgow and in Edinburgh. And he died in 1662, just as everything was being unraveled by Charles II. Mm-hmm. But he wrote the first commentary on the Westminster Confession, which was his lectures to his students. He was expounding it to his theology students. And he also was very important in covenant theology and developing covenant theology and the application of that in pastoral context. So a lot there in terms of, a faithful preacher, also a faithful expositor. He wrote many commentaries and he urged other people to get involved in those. And they were expositions that were designed for the ordinary person, the ordinary working man, that he could come back after a day's work and dig into the scriptures for maybe half an hour. And he was something that we just give him a window into the scriptures and how to apply them. So,
are his sermons on Lamentations reflective of his larger preaching ministry and his exposition? If so, or even if not, what is unique or particular about this collection?
Yeah, it does seem to sort of reflect his usual practice. We don't have a lot of published sermons by Dixon. There are some which were actually published by Naftali Press in the 1990s. But they do reflect his practice. His practice was to take three or four verses for his text and to give the people a substantial portion of God's word. And then he would just try to not take out everything that was possible to take out of that passage, but just the things that were most necessary and profitable. He talked about how when a preacher comes to a text, it should be like coming to a tree, and a man would shake the tree, and then what is ripe fruit will just sort of fall down and you'll be able to gather that. And so he was sort of saying, that's how it should be. You don't take everything out of a text. You just just take what you can. So yeah, he doesn't bring out all the possible interpretations, but there's a lot of application here. It's really heavily weighted to application. I think that's what really stands out when you come to the sermons. And so he's applying it to the contemporary context, to national events, to the church, to individual people in his parish. You know, there's such a breadth and depth of application there that's going on. And it's also kind of a homely style, I would say. You know, there's lots of proverbs here, a way that's designed to appeal to the ordinary person in the pew, whatever level of education they've got, you know. And he had quite a turn of phrase with illustrations, being able to compare things to each other, quite quick to find spiritual applications of things that happened. So that's very much, you know, the standard David Dixon's sermons. Yeah.
Mm. It was interesting to me to review the dates of Dixon and then also see his preaching ministry, I should say more broadly speaking, his pastoral ministry within the context of Scotland and all of the upheaval and changes that were going on at the time. You make note here that the year Dixon had been ordained was the very year that some of the most significant changes were forced on the Church of Scotland. Can you rehearse some of those changes to us and explain to us how Dixon really, as a kind of a nonconformist, really exemplified biblical fidelity and other things regarding not just doctrine, but also biblical practice, particularly in worship?
Yeah. Well, he was ordained in that year. And in that year, what the bishops and the king were trying to do was really to harmonize the Presbyterian Church of Scotland with the Anglican Church of England. So, but basically the king and the bishops were forcing on the church in an assembly, a general assembly that happened in that year, 1618. And it wasn't a free assembly. It wasn't that they were discussing things and then saying, this is more biblical. Here's all the biblical reasons why we should, for instance, bring in confirmation, you know, which was seen to be, you know, well, it's obviously one of the Roman Catholic sacraments, and that's the way it was seen in Scotland. Mm. So it wasn't like they were saying, you know, here's the biblical arguments for doing that. They just said, the king wants this. You've got to vote for this. We're taking down the names of anyone who doesn't vote for it. And, you know, we'll investigate that. So it was manipulation. It was royal intervention in that way. Just a real state control and just brute force that was driving these things through. And as you see, as I said, you know, in 1622, then Dixon is banished because he won't stop preaching about this. After he's ordained, he falls ill and he starts to think seriously about this, and he starts to reflect on it, and he looks at the way in which, just the unspiritual way that this is being forced through, and he thinks, this is all wrong. This doesn't reflect Scripture. He's convinced of the regulative principle of worship, that it's not, these things aren't indifferent, but that we have to stick to the commands of Scripture in relation to worship. And he's prepared to suffer for that. As many were at that time. There's an interesting, one of my favorite examples of his outlook at this time, just before he was banished. They were praying together, and this is in 1621, so it's exactly 400 years ago this year. Mm. And they were praying together, a lot of ministers, and just really burdened and didn't have liberty in prayer because of all that was going on. And then Dixon, who was a young man at that time, was asked to lead in prayer. And he just had such enlargement of spirit, and he had great faith and assurance that God would deliver them and that God would once more gloriously appear and deliver his church in the future. And people were so affected by that, they felt assured that it would happen as if it had already happened. You know, that was the degree of faith and assurance that he had. So it was... that was the nature of David Dixon, you know, sort of deeply spiritual, powerful in prayer. And he, what the Scottish Church did during that time was to really organise themselves in private meetings and in informal networks and ways in which they could really pray about the state of things. And ultimately, 10 years after Dixon's preaching these sermons, things turn around so that these things that were brought in, different unbiblical practices that were being forced on the church, were actually thrown out, and things were brought about to the revolution that then sparked the what would lead to the Westminster Assembly in England.
Matthew, tell us a little bit about the 30 Years' War and, you know, that is kind of setting context for Dixon.
Yeah. The 30 Years' War actually starts as well in 1618, and it's a conflict where the Roman Catholic powers in Europe are really trying to use military force to roll back the Reformation in different countries in Europe. And when Dixon looks across the sea to Europe, he's seeing Reformed seminaries like Heidelberg being just wiped off the map, and their libraries being decimated, and he's seeing, you know, churches like in what we would think of as Czechoslovakia being just completely wiped out. And then you've got just the brutality of it. It's one of the most brutal conflicts. And, you know, obviously by the name, it lasts a long time, but you've got thousands of people and many civilians are affected by it through famine and different other aspects of the brutality of it. So it's a really bloody, terrible period. And the great fear in 1628 is that Scotland will be invaded. And that's behind this. That's, and Irvine's a seaport. You know, there's that fear that, you know, maybe they will be invaded. And then also in 1628, you have the Huguenots in France being besieged by the French state, effectively, and there's La Rochelle, which is a seaport, and it is being besieged. The English go to try to give help to them, but it's abortive, and that is exactly the time when Dixon is preaching this. They're getting news of this. Here's these Protestants; they're in fear of their lives. They're being besieged. Maybe this is the sort of thing that would happen to us, but we ought to have a fellow feeling with them. And the Scottish Church does, and it has these fasts more than several times, you know, sort of national fasts, you know, distinctly for the French people. So they really feel at one with the French Protestants. They raise money for them, and they have that kind of internationalism that you almost wouldn't think of as having people having at that time. That's the experience that they've got. So you've got this context of international upheaval that also brings with it this economic and social upheaval. So it's a real tumultuous context in which to be preaching these sermons.
Sure.
And what Dixon does is he says, you need to look at this. You need to look at what's happening in the continent. Look at those churches that are being destroyed, and if you don't care about that, then that's a sign that you don't really care as you should about Christ's church. And maybe what will happen is that that will happen here. So he's trying to sort of give people this concern for the church and the church's afflictions, whether it's abroad or whether it's at home.
It's interesting for you to explain things that way and for us to have this historical context of Dixon preaching sermons from Lamentations in the midst of this 30 years war in which 8 million people died, roughly, from either violence, famine, or plague. And then if we think about the redemptive historical context of the Book of Lamentations, we have Jeremiah existing and preaching and lamenting the fall of the covenant people of God and them having been taken into exile. I mean, as the book begins, he exclaims, "How lonely sits this city that was full of people? How like a widow has she become? She who was great among the nations, she who was a princess among the provinces, has become a slave." Now he's looking back on all of this devastation. How does Dixon, in a sense, now surely he isn't, well, I hope not confusing the kingdom of Scotland for, you know, making it identical with the covenant people of God in some nationalistic sort of way. Nevertheless, how does he apply the plight of God's people thousands of years before to the pending or potential destruction and the existing, you know, destruction and devastation that they're experiencing as a result?
I think one of the interesting thing is that he does focus a lot on the church's afflictions. And one of the things he says is that the great benefit of the Book of Lamentations is that it allows us to look at the worst possible case scenario, you know, so it couldn't get worse than this. You know, there's a complete devastation, destruction in the land, but most of all, the temple's wiped out, you know, so all the ordinances, everything connected with God's worship is just removed, and not just removed, you know, at that moment in time, but for posterity, as far as they knew. And so that's, you know, as I say, the worst possible case scenario. And so Dixon says, that's what you need to do with the Book of Lamentations. You need to look at that and take a look at that in the cold light of day and say, that's what could happen. And you need to prepare yourself then for afflictions that might happen. You need to prepare yourself for further decline, potentially, of the church, but you need to work and pray and act in behalf of the church and take seriously the way in which, you know, decline leads to further decline and how these things can suddenly happen. And it is kind of strange in a way how, you know, we've lived through this pandemic and in different churches, different nations, you know, the churches have had to close. I'm speaking to you from Scotland, and today they've published legislation that makes that you know, orders the churches to close by law, and makes it a criminal offence, you know, to attend public worship for the first time, as far as I can see in history. Mm-hmm. So Dixon talks about these things. How should we respond to that? You know, he says that this is the worst thing that could happen, that God could just decide to remove something that is the dearest thing to him and the thing that gives him most glory. Why would God do that? Why would he take away his worship? And he says, well, it's only if he's not getting the glory that he ought to be getting by it, which is, you know, it really brings you up short when you read some of these things and in the context of where we're at. And, I'm not taking it, you know, too far. You know, people can draw their own conclusions, but it really just certainly tries to make, it certainly makes you think about what's happening and the significance of it.
Mm-hmm. It is also encouraging that even in the midst of this utter devastation, and as we could say, it can't get any worse than this, in those dark moments. Nevertheless, the book of Lamentations, Jeremiah, the prophet, and then the Spirit of God, of course, inspiring this book, gives us chapter 3, you know, and, mm-hmm. and speaks of how the mercies of God are new every morning, and great is thy faithfulness, you know. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases, and that his mercies are new every morning. Each and every day, he provides that which we need, just as he did through the wilderness with God's people, providing them daily bread, manna. They were called to look to the Lord each and every day for their sustenance, like whether you're living post-exile, immediately post-exile, or a new covenant people of God living in Scotland during the 30 Years' War. God still provides and gives to his people that which they need. That's why I think it's so interesting and encouraging and useful to see a preacher such as Dixon connecting with the people on these things. So he can connect these theological truths in a way that could be understood and in a way that would be encouraging. There's still a place for theological treatises on the subject, of course, and to understand God's decrees and, you know, how sin and devastation in the world comes about there. But to me, at least, that seems to be some of the great value here in these sermons on Lamentations and why it's helpful for us as a contemporary church.
Yeah. I mean, it helps us to know how to respond to that. And as you say, you know, there's great hope that's there. And I love the way that Dixon talks about how there is such a bleak picture in Lamentations chapter 3, but he says you see Jeremiah and he's wrestling. He's not just completely numb to what's going on, right, but he's right. Wrestling and he's waiting. And he says if you wrestle and keep wrestling till you get the blessing, he says Jeremiah is like a drowning man, but eventually he manages to catch hold of a bush, if you like. And what he catches hold of is God's unchanging covenant and God's unchanging character. And that's the same. That's what we need to catch hold of in our personal afflictions and in the context that we have, which is full of so many changes.
Yeah. Maybe more of a philosophical question, and this is not something that you know, kind of comes up directly in the book. It's not a book on hermeneutics, in other words, right? Mm-hmm. It is a book on homiletics, however, mm-hmm. Because it is homiletics in practice. So how do you maybe reflect a little bit upon the way in which David Dixon hermeneutically approaches maybe the Old Testament more generally, Lamentations more particularly? How does he understand the relationship between the nation of Israel under the terms of the Old Covenant and then the church living in tumultuous times in Scotland in the 17th century? So more of a kind of a homiletical / hermeneutical bridging kind of question, how he tackles this kind of difference in time, this redemptive historical transition that he needs to make from the old into the new, and particularly 17th century Scotland.
Yeah, he does, you know, draw applications for, you know, both the nation and for the church. He will bridge that gap by saying, you know, this is what happened in relation to the temple and how, you know, he'll compare obviously the aspects of temple worship and then think about how that could be applied. You know, so if aspects of the temple worship were being taken away, then how does that apply, you know, to the worship of the church? Possibly he does make, you know, quite a fairly direct comparison. I suppose they thought of Scotland as a covenanted nation, and, you know, that was their perspective. And so, you know, they did kind of have while they didn't just say, well, we are Israel, there was a connection there in terms of how they approached it. But he certainly has a Christ-centered view of the Old Testament and how to apply it. One person said that he labored to find Christ in every text that he preached on it, but he doesn't, what you'll notice is that he doesn't kind of strain at that. You know, he does it carefully, and he draws that kind of application. So for instance, he talks about how maybe the Nazarites were types of Christ. Now, different people have different views on the types and how far they go, etc. But he works these things out, and he talks about how, you know, the different kings were types of Christ, and he's able to then, you know, sort of talk about how, you know, for instance, the passage in chapter 5 that talks about the anointed of the Lord. You know, that's obviously a significant term, the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed. And so he brings a Christ, you know, centered application in there. But he doesn't just jump there, you know, he draws it out carefully and shows us how it's almost like he's modeling how to interpret the scriptures, you know, for his congregation, which is, you know, which is a helpful way for a preacher, obviously, to do that.
You know, you were so well, I think, connecting there the hermeneutic and the hermeneutical and the homiletical, right? Mm-hmm. And the way in which in pastoral ministry, not only are we seeking to minister Christ to people, but we're also seeking to minister how we receive Christ in the Word.
On that front, there's much to be said, and I think I love how you write here in the toward the end of the introduction in the volume. There's a heavy, lengthy introduction that's most enjoyable. You list at least two things, perhaps many more that we could also say. But you know, if we're asking the question, how is Dixon's life instructive for our contemporary church? You kind of answer with at least two things: that David Dixon helps us to recover the true glory of the church, and that he also helps us to be watchful. I'm wondering if you could further elaborate on those two points.
Yeah, one of the things I find really intriguing and rich about that aspect of the church's true glory is how David Dixon turns what you would say a negative into a positive. You know, so in the Book of Lamentations, you've got the nations around Israel, and they're mocking Israel and Jerusalem particularly, and they're using the language of Scripture. They're using Psalm 50, where it talks about Jerusalem being the perfection of beauty, and using the language of Psalm 48, the joy of the whole earth. And he says, well, that's actually what, you know, Jerusalem was. And actually, that's what the church is, you know, if you think about, you know, the New Testament, Jerusalem, and using that hermeneutical principle there. So he turns that into what's a negative there, that they've lost that glory. He says, no, the church has a true glory, and we need to understand what that is. It's a spiritual glory. It's a heavenly glory. It's not an outward glory. And that's why those who are unspiritual, those who are worldly, they can't see it. And it just doesn't seem like anything to them. And what he talks about is some of the benefits, and their spiritual benefits that the church has that no one else has. This is the most glorious ornament, he says, that the earth has. And I think probably one of, you know, all other glory is perishing besides this. But one of the most beautiful passages is where he really gets into this, and he says, you know, this is your glory and prerogative. This is your beauty. You have God for your husband. You may kiss the Son of God and not be despised. You may knock, he says, at the King of Heaven's door and be sure to be let in. You may get the Spirit to inform you and lead you into all truth, the heavenly manner of his word to your food. So he's saying, put on this beauty and glory. Seek the face of your Lord. Deck yourself with this glory. And again, you know, the other passage that where he talks about that glory of the church is when he talks about the fine gold becoming dim at the beginning of chapter 4 of Lamentations. And so he's talking about, well, what is that fine gold that belongs to the church? It's a spiritual glory. It's the richness of holiness, that beauty that it ought to have. So you can see he's making that spiritual connection there. And there again is that sort of hermeneutical principle coming in, showing people how to interpret the scriptures, but also, you know, to apply it. And of course that applies, you know, to the church's worship, you know, where they were trying to bring in things that were of human preference and human invention. And so he talks about how the golden purity of worship can have this human invention sort of mixed with it. And then that makes the glory, the true glory of the church, become dim and overclouded, and not what it should be, because it's a heavenly and a spiritual glory.
Well, certainly that's not relevant today, is it? I mean, that is such a timely word in today's day and age, where unfortunately we're maybe even seeing Reformed churches, right, kind of open themselves to this mixture of things that are pleasing to man and will worship with divine worship. So timely message indeed.
Yeah.
How does Dixon help us to be more watchful against some of these things, or to come to understand divine chastisements even, given his context? How might that translate to ours?
Sure. One of the things he talks about is he has a future focus. So it's sort of being watchful about providence, about what God is doing, about events that affect the life of the church, trends within the church particularly. But he has this future focus where he's saying that one of the great concerns for the church ought to be the rising generation, ought to be the posterity. And that was one of the great griefs, he says, for Jerusalem, to see the children suffer and to think these children are not going to see the temple. They're going to grow up without the ordinances of God. And to have that kind of concern almost, and Dixon says this, I mean, one of the things he says is that we ought to be more concerned for what afflicts the church and the misery of the church than even our own personal misery and our own personal affliction. But he has this focus on the future. And he says that that, you know, can be the greatest grief of the church, to think what's going to happen to the gospel, what's going to happen to the church in the future. And the danger where, as he puts it, you know, what we think is indifferent and tolerable, so, you know, some of these changes that we've been, you know, hinting at, the next generation thinks is good and expedient. You know, so what we just tolerate and think, well, you know, that will be helpful, the next generation start to celebrate it. And so you get this decline. And the remedy for that is to really focus on catechizing and instructing the rising generation in God's revealed will and bringing them up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. The other thing he talks about is making use of the days of peace, such as we have them, in preparation for darker and more difficult days. And it's quite remarkable how he, and I'm not saying it's like some sort of prophetic insight, because he could see how things were going, he could see how things were on the continent and in other places, but he actually predicts, you know, that warfare is going to break out in the British Isles, and it does within 10 years. And he's able to sort of see that sort of bleak future, the way that things are going, the decline within the church. And yet he has this hope that's founded upon God, upon God's unchangeable character. And that's one of the things that he ends the book with, because Lamentations ends like that. He says, God can repair the church's ruins. God can, you know, wipe away the tears and the shame You know, if we're brought to a repentance and a returning back to him, you know, how it ends in Lamentations, turn us and we shall be turned. Renew our days as the days of old. It's a great prayer for the church. And he says, you know, that's what God can do. And our hope is to be in the unchanging character, the unchanging goodness of God and his covenant, you know, towards his church. However much we see change and decay and all around. Yeah.
Absolutely. Matthew, this has been really fascinating, and I'm happy to be introduced to David Dixon in kind of a new way. I was aware of him to a degree, but not very familiar with this historical context, but also to get to know the man through your introduction and then start to learn about him and kind of get to know and become familiar with him through his exposition and preaching has also been a joy. So I encourage people to take a look at this. The book, of course, Sermons on Jeremiah's Lamentations by David Dixon in the Naphtali Press Special Editions. We're very thankful to Naphtali Press for this, also the support and work of Reformation Heritage Books. But if you want more information on the book and how to get a hold of it, head on over to naphtali.com, naphtali.com. But Matthew, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I'm encouraged and I'm very thankful for your generosity.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great to speak about David Dixon and the relevance of these things and the riches that we can still experience today.
Amen. Amen. And of course, head on over to reformationscotland.org. You can find information about what Matthew's up there in Scotland. And if you'd like a copy of the book for free, a giveaway copy, we have three. Again, subscribe to the email newsletter. And the Thursday following the publication of this podcast, I will go through and randomly select three and get in touch with you. So check your email inbox that Thursday or Friday and see if we can connect. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.